aspects of the Texas lifestyle. Each week, Recording Library of West Texas volunteers and staff dig through the files of the National Magazine of Texas to bring you Texas Monthly Archives. You'll hear biographical articles about some of the most fascinating Texans, feature stories covering interesting places and things in Texas, and short pieces that are humorous and thought-provoking. Tune in to hear these stories covering contemporary Texas from the 70s, 80s, and 90s that would otherwise be lost to time. Texas Monthly Archives, Thursday nights at 7, Sunday afternoons at 2, and Mondays at midnight on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 57 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program covering a wide variety of topics of interest to people with vision loss. I'm Nancy Goodman Torpey.
And I'm Pete Torpey.
It is called Dark Room Ballet because it has personal meaning to me and my personal history. But also, if you think about what is a dark room in photography, it's a place where things develop. And the dark room is time for you to develop as an artist.
And we'll hear more from our guest today, not only about learning ballet and smooth dance movements, but also we'll learn how we can be more in touch with our bodies and what our bodies are trying to tell us and how to use various parts of our bodies.
We'll speak with Krishna Washburn, a professional ballet dancer and dance instructor who runs Dark Room Ballet, through which she teaches dance classes. And we'll talk with her about her instructional methods, her experiences as a professional blind ballet dancer, as well as how her online classes work. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Krishna Washburn.
My tip is definitely has to do with the way we think about ourselves as learners. If you can imagine yourself learning something new, that is step one. If there's ever been something you felt like, oh, this is beyond me, this is something I will never be able to learn how to do, that message probably came from outside you and does not represent you authentically. If there's something that you've wanted to do that you felt discouraged from, think about yourself doing it. Imagine yourself doing it. Your nervous system will be primed and you'll be ready to learn.
And if nothing else, Krishna is very enthusiastic about encouraging people to learn body movements, including dance. But her tip is applicable to anything you might think about learning.
Support for Eyes on Success is provided by
NaviLens, a four-color QR code designed to be located and read from up to 60 feet away without the need to focus on it. Personal places and items can be tagged and shared with family and friends with codes obtained inside the NaviLens app, available for iPhone and Android. More information is at NaviLens.com.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success.
Let's start by meeting Krishna.
Hi, I'm Krishna Washburn from Dark Room Ballet. I'm a blind professional dancer and dance educator.
Have you been blind your entire life?
No. I was formerly a sighted person, and I was in Royal Academy of Dance ballet education through most of my childhood and young adult years.
Oh, so you really had dance in your background then. You've been doing this for a long time.
Yes, I was scouted when I was 3.
Wow. So are you British? You sound American.
I am not British. I am a New Yorker. I live in Manhattan. I live in Sugar Hill in the heart of Harlem.
And you say you're a dance instructor.
I do teach group class and private class. I teach ballet technique with the educational needs of blind and visually impaired people as my center principal. Unlike most ballet teachers, I actually have a master's of education, and I have a considerable research background in biomechanics through the American College of Sports Medicine. And I have also had the fortunate opportunity to study with a blind master dancer named Mana Hashimoto, who's taught me a lot of our specific traditional learning of dance for blind folks. So all of that is what informs my teaching. I teach group class Monday night, and I teach privates all the time.
This year, many performances have been canceled, but in other years, do you continue to perform?
I've performed with many dance companies. I was principal dancer with Infinity Dance Theater for more than 3 years. I've worked with, you know, Heidi Latsky Dance. I've worked with, you know, Marked Dance Project. I have done a lot of my own work in choreography. I think that probably in 2019, I probably performed a minimum of once a month, probably more like twice a month.
Wow, that's really something. So back to your teaching, we don't usually discuss prices on the show unless something is free, and I understand your group classes are free.
Both group classes and private classes studying with me through Darkroom Ballet are free and are always free.
Which is very generous of you.
I feel like it is a very important thing for me to address, because most of my students are blind people like myself. And there is an important thing that needs to be talked about in disability community that I think is not talked about enough, which is education denial. Education denial is somebody else deciding what information and what education you need to know or what you deserve to know. And a lot of information about our own human bodies are denied to disabled people. So when I interact with students for the first time, we have to have a lot of in-depth conversations about, like, what do we actually know about our own physical bodies before we can feel calm and comfortable and confident enough to actually embark on something that requires so much focus as studying dance.
Support for Eyes on Success is made possible in part by our corporate partners.
Find out more about partnership opportunities by sending an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
This week's focus topic is why it is important to understand your body, and also some opportunities to take dance classes intended for people with disabilities.
Just to make sure all of our listeners are on the same page, we talked a lot about your ballet performances and teaching, but that isn't the main topic that you wanted to discuss today. And you brought that up in the introduction about education denial and what blind people might be missing about knowing about their own bodies. Can you give us sort of an executive summary of what you're talking about there, and then we can talk about some specific examples?
If you don't understand how your body works and how your anatomy works, it's very difficult to believe that you can learn new physical skills. What I aim to do in the way that I teach people is to give them information about how their body works and how to sense how things feel on the inside. So that way they can have that confidence in that knowledge that they can learn so much more than they've ever been told that they can learn.
Yeah, I can imagine that having a good sense of your body and how it feels and what it can do can be very important in dance and sports and other activities. But I get the impression that you feel blind people are particularly disadvantaged at knowing about these cues.
Yes, and I think a lot of that has to do with lack of specific, explicit, direct anatomy education for blind and visually impaired people. I think a lot of teachers assume things.
For example?
Well, I have had conversations with students in which, you know, we talked about, like, you know, how do we sense and isolate different parts of our body? You can't do that unless you actually know what they are. If you can touch it and feel it for yourself, that's how you actually come to know what it is. So my day zero class for students is almost always an introduction to what your foot is all about. Because we all know, okay, I have feet, whatever, I have toes. Yeah, all right. But there is so much more and so much more specificity to that that you have the capacity to learn. I have some students who say, you know, I'm not even 100% clear what part of my foot is my heel and what counts as the arch and this and that. And you need to actually know these things if you're going to come to trust your feet to be able to do these kinds of complex movements.
Well, that's interesting. We do talk about our body parts like I have a foot, I have an arm, but indeed a foot is a really complex mechanism with a lot of interconnecting bones, muscles, and ligaments.
So what I'm going to give you right now, Peter, and for all of the folks who are listening, an opportunity to understand what your foot is all about, feel it, and then get a renewed sense of trust in it that might send you on a journey of being able to trust yourself to learn new and interesting and exciting things.
Let's do it.
So if you touch your own foot, let's start on the bottom of our foot at the very back. At the very back is our heel. Now, if you feel up the back of your leg that attaches to your heel, you're going to feel a strong piece of connective tissue. It feels almost like plastic. That is your Achilles tendon. Your Achilles tendon is attached to the sole of your foot, and also it goes into your calf muscle. That's the muscle that is in the back of your lower leg. And every time you move your ankle, that Achilles tendon is there to support you. It's extremely strong. It's almost like one of the cables that can support a suspension bridge. That's your Achilles tendon. Now, if we crawl up into the middle, we have this empty gap here, this curved part of our foot. That is our arch. Inside there is a square-shaped muscle that's called the quadratus plantarum. That is our architecture for our foot. That is what holds its strength. That's what lets our foot move. And it is just like a cathedral's arch. It supports from the inside. Now, if you keep going forward, before you reach your toes, you have this part of your foot, which is called the ball of your foot. That's where all of your nerves are most prominent in your foot. Inside there are some nerves that are so large, they're about as thick as a pencil. And they are extremely sensitive, and they can learn to feel things like tape on the floor that you might use if you start studying dance with a blind teacher. And you will be able to sense through those nerves your own balance. If you touch the top of your foot, you're going to feel your metatarsal bones. In between each metatarsal bone, there is a big nerve. And if you can touch it in just the right spot with your finger, you might even feel a little bit of an electrical sensation.
So you can feel a little tingling if you hit the right spot, I guess.
Yes, you can. If you think about yourself as a blind person and how you have trained your hands to do extraordinary things, whether that's reading Braille, whether that is using a white cane, whether that's cooking, whether that is, you know, fiber arts, think of all the amazing things you have learned how to do with your hands. Your feet have the same capacity, if not more so, for learning and neurological learning. Your feet can start to learn things that you cognitively are not even aware of yet. Your peripheral nervous system can absorb information that takes time for you to metacognitively understand.
Well, that's an interesting point. We don't often consciously think about our feet unless we drop a rock on it or something.
But our feet can be something that can give us confidence and calm, whether it's learning dance, whether it is learning different sports and exercise, whether it is traveling out in the world. If you know that you can trust what your feet feel because you have sensitized it, because you have connected your brain to your foot, it opens up a whole new world to you.
Well, I confess, I've learned a fair amount of foot anatomy, but it's one little piece at a time because I injured that little piece. Now, I never knew what a plantar fascia was until I got plantar fasciitis. And all of a sudden, that was really important to me. And I believe that, you know, if I and all of my compatriots who've had the same injuries knew more about our feet, we would probably have been less likely to injure them in whatever way we did.
Body awareness is so important for injury prevention. What you're describing is such an important and oftentimes a missing piece in our physical education, especially for disabled folks.
And I guess particularly for blind people, you gave a very thorough and detailed description of the components of the foot and how they interact and their importance. But a blind person isn't likely to see the picture of a foot in a textbook or on a poster in a doctor's office. Or if they're taking a class and the teacher says, well, touch here or go over here, they just don't get the same feedback. And that's kind of the point you're making, I guess.
You really need to be working with an anatomy teacher who understands where you're at and what tools you have at your disposal to learn.
Then in your classes, I suppose you go through a similar exercise for many of the other body parts and how we can be more aware of them and know how they're put together and how they work.
Yes, that's exactly what I do in class. When I was talking about that place where our Achilles tendon meets our heel, that's our magic balancing point. People don't know that. They think, oh, I have to balance on my foot. Our magic balancing point is that very back point where our Achilles tendon finds our heel. If you can learn how to connect that heel to the floor strongly when you stand, your balancing is automatically so much easier. A lot of people think, oh, well, people use sight to balance. If I don't have sight to help me, I'll never learn how to balance easily. That is not true. There are other avenues into learning balance. And that's something that we work on in class together every week.
And I guess particularly for people who begin to have vision problems later in life, they may not have developed these subconscious ways of obtaining feedback from their various body parts, like their feet and their balance. Whereas having an intellectual awareness of these things and a detailed accounting of how it all works, like you just gave, can be important in developing those skills later in life when you might need them more.
Also, it's a great opportunity to make the subconscious conscious, to take those things that your nervous system already knows and turn it into something that you can choose to do, something that you can make a choice in the moment. That's really what dance is.
So what fraction of your classes focus on dance or on these concepts? Is it sort of a collection of these things?
Well, my class is progressive. Every class we learn new things. But if you start with day zero with me, you will learn anatomy first, and then moving into shapes and technique, and then choreography, and then performance.
Describe to us a bit more of, if someone's interested in your classes, what is the process they go through, and how does this all work?
It is very, very easy to start studying with Darkroom Ballet. You just send an email to info@darkroomballet.com, and you'll get in touch with me and with my administrator, Alejandra. And depending on your degree of prior knowledge, you might start out with private classes. You might segue into group class right away. It all depends on what's right for you. I teach real people, not hypothetical people.
So there are a variety of options.
Yes. And it is something that we have a conversation with together to decide what's right for you to start out. I want to make it clear that these classes are not only for people who are studying at the introductory level. I have blind professionals who come and take class with me as well, which is very fun. And it is a true open level class. And it's really, you know, blind dance community time. Like, I have beautiful, famous New York blind dancers like Kayla Hamilton, Christopher Umpes Verde Nunez, Yael Palumpas, who come and study with me, and it is a beautiful time.
And I guess even over Zoom, there are opportunities to interact with the teacher, ask questions if you're having some problems or falling behind. So people shouldn't be shy about doing it over the internet.
Well, this is how my class is set up. First of all, I have a very sensitive audio setup to make sure I never ever have lag between music and my voice, which involves two laptops, a very expensive speaker, and a very expensive microphone. It's very, very complex setup. Before the first hour of class, we have 15 minutes of audio balancing with every single song I'm planning to use in class. A lot of students love to come early and help me balance my audio, and we have a little, you know, community time. Then we have an hour of technique, all mics off except for mine. It's time for all the students to just focus on how they feel inside their body, relate to their bodies, relate to what they're hearing in their ears, and just concentrate for an hour. Then from 9 to 9:30 Eastern Standard Time, it is question and answer time. And let me tell you, that half hour is not enough. I am staying on there for 45 minutes these days because we have such wonderful conversations as a group. The dancers really get to know each other, and we have so many wonderful conversations about learning. I make sure everybody feels comfortable with what we covered in class, and it's really the most supportive environment for learning there could be.
And I just want to reiterate, I'm pretty sure you said that you have all different levels of skill and experience in the same class, so nobody should feel intimidated?
That is right. In fact, the fact that we do have blind professionals dancing alongside with us should be encouragement. Because not only do you have my voice, but you have their voice, and all of us care so deeply about anyone who has the courage and the drive to come and study dance in the dark room.
So you call this dark room ballet. Do you do it with the lights out, or for the benefit of your partially sighted students, is there actually a video component?
Oh, there is definitely a video component because I do have partial students. That's one of the reason why I usually dress in colors like orange when I teach.
As long as your background isn't the same color.
Well, I have a black floor. So I use orange guide tape, and I'm usually dressed in bright colors for their benefit. I do also have some sighted students, but most of them are seated dancers. Some of them are professional wheelchair dancers who come and study with me because this is disability family time. So I do use the camera. It is called Dark Room Ballet because it has personal meaning to me and my personal history. But also, if you think about what is a dark room, In photography, it's a place where things develop. And the darkroom is time for you to develop as an artist.
This has been wonderful. Is there anything you'd like to add?
I really feel like blind folks deserve the highest quality education.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never give them anything second best. I have myself known of and witnessed so many sighted people offering dance and movement classes to blind community, and it's really not well thought through, and it's really disrespectful because they don't think about it as, you know, I am educating people. They really think like, oh, well, you know, I'm doing a good deed for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't like that way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a real teacher, and I want my students to come away feeling like they're continuously learning. And the only way you can do that is to treat people with a lot of respect.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Now for this week's final item, how to learn more about darkroom ballet, including how to sign up for classes, and how to contact Krishna Washburn directly.
If people wanted to sign up for some of your classes or find out more, how could they do that?
Well, I have a very easy website. It is darkroomballet.com, and you can send me an email at info@darkroomballet.com.
Do you have a social media presence?
I am on Facebook. You can search Darkroom Ballet on Facebook. That is me. I'm also launching a Patreon page in the very near future to support not only the Darkroom Ballet educational community, but a disability arts community project that I have launched with my friend Heather Shaw out in California. The Telephone Dance and Audio Description Game, which is a beautiful art project which is all about creating art that includes blind and visually impaired people. Well, you can look up Telephone Dance and Audio Description Game on Patreon. That is me, Krishna Washburn, and Heather Shaw.
And for listeners who may not be familiar with Patreon, can you tell them a little bit about what that is or how to find it?
Patreon is a website that does crowdfunding for artists. patreon.com.
Are there any other forums people should check to find your work?
They can listen to me on BBC Radio 4 Shortcuts episode, The Interpreter, to learn more about the arts projects that I do. I also did a radio program with the lovely Brian McCallan of Speak Out for the Blind, which is available for folks to listen to. A lot of people have found out about me through an article that was published through several USA Today affiliates, like the Green Bay Gazette and North Jersey newspaper. And I also have a new, very in-depth article with Bloom Magazine about my educational and artistic philosophies.
And of course, you can always check out the show notes associated with this episode if you're looking for any of that contact information, or if you're interested in learning more or taking some of these classes. Just go to www.eyesonsuccess.net.
That's it for show number 2113. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking with Tony Giles, who's been on this show several times, and you may know him by his moniker, Tony the Traveler. Tony is totally blind and partially deaf and has traveled the world alone. And he's written books about his experiences and has most recently published one about traveling in southern Africa. And that is what we will be talking with him about next week.
Tony always has a fun story. And in fact, next week you'll learn what to do if you're being attacked by an ostrich. So join us next week.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpy and Peter Torpy, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio.
You can access the full archive of previous shows, subscribe to the podcast, and much more by going to our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. If you have questions about anything you've heard on the show or have suggestions for future shows, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
Thank you for listening and have a nice day.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Men's Health Magazine, followed by USA Today at 2.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, March 20th, 2021. Community calendar. Bass and PBS will host Marty Stewart and his fabulous band for a street party on May 6th. Tickets are $70. The Aphasia Center is hosting its annual Aphasia Awareness Concert on May 7th at the Horseshoe. Queen Nation, a Queen tribute band, will perform.
Of all the interesting places in our country, the American West may just have the most interesting stories. Recording Library of West Texas volunteer Jack reads articles from Range, American Cowboy, and other publications on the Western Magazine Hour, Wednesday mornings at 11 and again Sunday afternoons at 5 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 59 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Peter Gilmore, and I'll be reading Men's Health Magazine here on site into Sound Radio. First up, protein, but better. Called a great protein flavor recession. Over the past few decades, something happened to grocery store beef, chicken, and fish. It all started to taste the same. The main culprit, industrial farms producing bland meat and giving animal protein a bad name. No wonder plant-based meat took off. But now smaller-scale farms are raising this how-it-should-be tasting animal proteins, while also enhancing the nutrition of the products. Better still, you can have them shipped to you. Here are just three of the many producers offering the good stuff, plus how to cook it right. Regenerative Ranching's Underdog. MLB star Adam LaRoche and his business partner have built a forward-thinking farm to bring you an MVP steak. There's one big reason the meat you eat at the steakhouse tastes sublime. Sourcing. Steakhouse owners know that delivering a tender, juicy, belly-patent ribeye, or tomahawk, or whatever, starts not in the kitchen, but on the cattle ranch. Enter Adam LaRoche. When he retired from baseball in 2016, he found himself with plenty of two things, land and time. LaRoche had opened a steakhouse back in 2013 and owned a 4,800-acre ranch in Fort Scott, Kansas. He had big dreams of raising better cattle that would help supply the steakhouse and sustain his family for generations to come. And so, with his business partner, rancher Jack Gross, he co-founded E3 Meat Company. LaRoche and Gross began by looking at the dirt. Healthy earth makes healthy grass, which makes healthy cattle, which makes healthy meat, which makes healthy people, says Gross. Their first change was to introduce paddock grazing, which the cattle eat only choice grasses. Yes, they can discern a difference, rather than consuming all the grass, which is tough on the soil, and poor soil demands chemical fertilizers and herbicides. The ranch also has implemented low-stress cattle management practices, raising the animals without using steroids or antibiotics, and never added hormones. The result? Luscious marble cuts of deeply beefy steak. While grass-fed is trendy, E3 grain finishes its beef. I mean, the flavor is familiar, powerfully hearty and almost buttery, yet elevated like a chop you're used to have at a steakhouse, only enjoy it at home. Steak packages, starting at $100, are available through e3ranch.com. Sear roasted beef tenderloin steaks. If you're buying by the mail order, you can often pick up specialty cuts, such as beef tenderloin roast, a massive hunk of lean meat that cooks up so sublime, you can skip the steak knife. Fear not screwing it up. Dividing the tenderloin into two roasts is a good option if you have multiple meat temps needs in your home. What you'll need: 1 5-7 pound trimmed beef tenderloin, halved to make two roasts, 2 tablespoons canola oil, 2 tablespoons butter, 2 whole garlic cloves, smashed, and 3 fresh thyme sprigs. How to make it? Pat the tenderloin dry with paper towels and allow it to rest at room temp for 2 hours. Preheat your oven to 425. Heat a large cast iron pan over medium heat. Generously season the tenderloin with kosher salt and fresh ground black pepper. Add the oil to the pan. When it begins to shimmer, sear the two roasts on all sides, 3 to 4 minutes aside. Remove the tenderloin from the pan and transfer to a roasting pan. Do not clean out the cast iron pan. Roast the meat according to the chart at right, about 10 to 15 minutes for rare, plus 5 to 10 additional minutes for every level of doneness thereafter. 4. Carefully remove the tenderloin from the oven. Heat the cast iron pan over medium. Melt 2 tablespoons of butter and add the garlic, thyme, and roasts. Baste for 1 to 2 minutes. Transfer the roast to a cutting board. Let them rest for about 5 to 10 minutes. Then slice and serve, topping with a little melted butter and pan drippings. This will feed 14 to 16 people. Timing the temp. Pull the meat out of the oven at the right doneness is critical to a delicious meal. Your best bet is to buy an instant read digital thermometer with an alarm. We like the $99 Smoke Remote BBQ Alarm Thermometer from thermoworks.com. Then cook the meat until your desired doneness using the following chart. Rare, 115 to 120. Medium rare, 120 to 125. Medium, 130 to 135. Medium well, 140 to 145. And finally, for some reason, well done, 150 to 155. Remember, as the meat rests, residual heat will continue to cook the beef 5 to 10 more degrees. The temperature above takes this into account. Quick note, consuming undercooked meat, that's below 145 degrees for tenderloin, may increase your risk of foodborne illness. Next, pastured poultry is the future. That's due to its supreme taste, nutrients, and ability to help small farmers grow. If you've been unimpressed with organic or free-range supermarket chickens, paying a few bucks more for a still bland bird, Cody Hopkins gets it. When he started his small farm in Arkansas in 2006, he bought a few chickens to raise for meat, largely because, well, they were cheap. Kind of the way most industrial farm chickens are raised, crowded together in warehouse-like buildings and given feed, Hopkins put his chickens in portable pens. He moved the pens every few days so the birds could peck fresh grass and clover. This simple act infused the meat with bold, almost floral flavors. There's a big difference between our chickens and one raised in a chicken house. Those chickens will never see the light of day, he says. Free range just means the birds can go outside, not that they actually do go outside. And due to their diet, pasture-raised chickens have higher levels of good polyunsaturated fats when compared with conventionally raised chickens. That's according to research from 2018. Though Hopkins has exceptional chickens, he couldn't find a processing plant that was willing to work with his small outfit. In the U.S., 18 large corporate farming operations, including Tyson, Perdue, and Pilgrim's Pride, control an estimated 90% of the meat chicken industry. And these companies often own their own processing plants. So Hopkins, and other like-minded farmers, partnered with a nonprofit, Heifer International, to start the Grassroots Farmers Cooperative, a coalition that shares processing resources. The group, founded in 2014, is now run out of 24 farms in 8 states and ships nationwide. Its pasture-raised chickens, a bestseller. It's $21 for a whole bird at grassrootscoop.com. Now, a yogurt marinated roast chicken. High quality pasture chicken has an almost herbal flavor. Highlight that by marinating the bird in a herb yogurt mixture. The acids in the yogurt will help to tenderize the meat. What will you need? Well, 1 3/4 cups of plain Greek yogurt, 1/2 cup olive oil plus 1 tablespoon, 2 cloves of garlic minced, a zest from 1 lemon plus 1 teaspoon of juice, 1/4 teaspoon minced parsley, 1/2 teaspoon minced rosemary, 1 pinch of saffron, that's optional by the way, 3 to 4 pounds of pasture-raised whole chicken, giblets removed, 1 onion, large dice, 3 ribs of celery, large dice, and finally 1 carrot, large dice. In a bowl large enough to fit the chicken, combine the yogurt, 1/2 cup olive oil, garlic, lemon zest, parsley, rosemary, saffron, 2 teaspoons salt, and 1/4 teaspoon freshly ground black pepper. Add the chicken and coat well with the yogurt mixture. Marinate covered in the refrigerator for 12 hours. Second, preheat your oven to 350. Rinse the chicken and pat it dry with a paper towel. Transfer the vegetables to the bottom of a large roasting pan. Sprinkle with sea salt and add the chicken breast side up. Tie the legs together close to the body of the chicken with twine. Rub the 1 tablespoon olive oil all over the chicken and then sprinkle with a tablespoon of sea salt. Roast the chicken until a meat thermometer inserted in the thickest part of the breast and thighs reaches 165 degrees. This should take about 90 minutes. Carefully remove the chicken from the oven. Let it rest for 15 minutes before carving. Should feed 6. This farm salmon is a very good thing. It's fattier, which means more benefits for your health and taste buds. You've heard about all the studies. People who eat fish rich in omega-3 fatty acids may reduce their risk of stroke, heart failure, Alzheimer's disease, and even depression. Yet Americans are still consuming only about 1/3 of the weekly recommended dosage of 8 ounces of fish and shellfish, according to the latest data from the USDA. But the fish farmers behind the company New Zealand King Salmon are raising salmon so delicious that it's hard not to want to eat more of it. And it's all due to fat. After cultivating 9 generations of fish, the company has managed to produce a salmon that has a fat content of 25%. If you were to compare that with wild salmon, it would be between 12 and 15%. And the fattier the fish, the greater the amount of DHA and EPA, 2 omega-3 fatty acids beneficial to your heart and brain. To raise its salmon, the company employs football-sized net pens that are 98% water and only 2% fish. At that density level, the waste is naturally composted, by the organism on the seabed. It does not build up. This method works incredibly well. In fact, Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch rates New Zealand salmon raised in open water net pens a best choice for sustainability. That's even better than wild-caught salmon from the U.S. and Canada. You can order 4 pounds of New Zealand King Salmon under the brand name of Ora King Salmon for $120 from Brown Trading Company at browntrading.com. That's Brown with an E, by the way. Now here's a recipe for jerk salmon. The heat and spice in this recipe's jerk marinade tag teams with the richness of a high-fat farm salmon. What you'll need: 1 head of garlic minced, 1 cup chopped scallions, 1 cup cilantro leaves, loosely packed, 1 Scotch bonnet pepper or habanero chili pepper, stemmed, 1 inch piece of fresh ginger, peeled and chopped, 2/3 cup molasses, 2/3 cup olive oil, 1 teaspoon ground allspice, 1/2 teaspoon ground cinnamon, 4 6-ounce skinless farm-raised salmon fillets, lime wedges for serving. So how do you make it? In a blender or food processor, add the garlic, scallions, 1 cup cilantro leaves, hot pepper, ginger, molasses, olive oil, allspice, and cinnamon. Season to taste with salt. Puree until smooth. In a large bowl, combine the salmon with half the pureed jerk marinade. Turn the fish to coat well. Refrigerate for 15 minutes. Preheat your oven to 375. Place the salmon on a non-stick baking sheet. Pour the rest of the marinade over it and roast until flaky, in about 8 to 10 minutes. Serve the lime wedges and some cilantro sprigs. Feeds about 4 people. I need to take a break here to remind you you're listening to Men's Health Magazine on site in the Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound on channel HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as on Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Next up, escape burnout. The pandemic has blurred the boundaries between our work and home lives, leaving many of us exhausted, cynical, and inefficient. Here's how we all can reboot this year. We'll give you the good news first. Surveys show that one side effect of the pandemic is that we're all more productive. Whoop, whoop. The bad news, some experts think it's because so many of us are working longer hours. An American psychologist, Herbert Fronberg, first popularized the term burnout in the 1970s after observing overworked staffers at a free New York City-based health clinic. He characterized burnout, the feeling of extreme fatigue, as a response to overwhelming stress and expectations. During the 2000s, the word would be used to describe any feelings of frustration, not those solely caused by job stress. For example, election burnout, work burnout, the list goes on. But 2020 brought us a new kind of burnout, as millions of Americans began working from home indefinitely. A year later, we're really feeling the effects. The three signs of burnout are exhaustion, cynicism, and inefficiencies. That's according to Dr. Jaquita Jimenez. And because society tells men they can't be tired or inefficient, they often push through, and that exhaustion becomes anger or irritability. Your tolerance takes a dip, and now you're annoyed by your coworker, or you insist the project you're working on is stupid. Burnout has been linked to several serious health conditions, including heart disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes. To escape a burnout spiral, try these 6 sanity-saving tweaks to your routine. Number 1, if you do this, check your inbox from bed. Do this instead. Take deep, focused breaths. Sure, getting a head start on work is well-intentioned, but it can set off your body's stress response. That can cause those feelings of early morning dread and anxiety that fuel burnout. Adding stressful stimuli into the mix, when your cortisol levels are already high, doesn't set you up for starting your day off calm, focused, and centered. As an alternative, try 1 minute of deep, slow breathing before getting out of bed. This will hack your nervous system so you feel calmer. If meditation, a morning run, yoga, or another soothing practice is more your speed, do that instead. Anything that helps you relax and recognize when you've lost that chill later in the day will be beneficial. If you wake up late, do this instead. Make time for a morning commute. Experts argue that imitating your pre-work-from-home habits can improve your mental health. Through a behavioral lens, all the activities that constituted your pre-work routine prime your brain to begin your workday. There are powerful gestures of association that calibrate your mind and body to transition to work mode. Doctors recommend a walk around the block to prepare for the day ahead. Aim to create other similar experiences from your pandemic routine, like reading the newspaper. If you do this, put off big projects. Do this instead. Rearrange your routine. Another common side effect of lockdowns is that many of us feel as if we have more time than we do, so we put off what we can do. Don't do it. In fact, doctors recommend scheduling your most challenging tasks around the time you've had your first coffee. While study results vary, experts say your peak mental focus is somewhere between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. But it's crucial to adjust your expectations and acknowledge that productivity can drop off throughout the day. Our brains are not machines. We can't expect the same level of output when we continue to push ourselves all day long. If you do this, scroll on your smartphone after hours. Do this instead. Recharge and reboot. Resilience isn't about how you endure. It's about how you recharge. Unfortunately, many of us have gotten lazy about our leisure time. Instead of engaging in what experts describe as true leisure, like going for a run in the park, we engage in consummatory leisure, like having a beer late in the day, or spillover leisure, like scanning social media on the couch. You need to focus on activities that fuel your soul and fill your capacity again. Spend time outside, or plan a home workout, anything to get you moving, even if you're stuck in the great indoors. If you do this, work like a hermit and become a recluse. Do this instead. Make connections. Without a social working environment, staying in contact requires more effort, but it's still important. Send a text message to a friend about playing fantasy football, or plan a working lunch with colleagues. Not only will they appreciate the gesture, you will also feel better for having the interaction. And recognize your and others' wins, too. We get a feel-good hit of dopamine in our brains from our celebrating wins. For example, drop a message into a Slack channel at work to broadcast your success. And finally, if you do this, stay on Slack 24/7. Do this instead. Create boundaries. When you work in an office, you have a physical end to your day once you leave your workplace. When you work from home, you might be tempted to keep working with no end in sight. Research shows that one way to combat burnout is role compartmentalization, or simply creating boundaries. Look for ways to detach from work, such as shutting down your computer at the end of the day, muting your Slack notifications, minimizing work on the weekends, and changing into play clothes. London Business School and Cornell University researchers found that working on days off negatively affected motivation and could lead to lower overall job satisfaction. If you must, mentally reframe work on weekends as work time rather than time off, and it can help stave off any loss of motivation. Next, America's sleepiest cities. Poor sleep can lead to heightened risk of diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. And if you just fell asleep reading the sentence, well, where you live may be to blame. We analyzed 100 of the largest U.S. cities and scored each according to the bedtimes of its residents and how many of them reported sleeping less than 7 hours a night on average. We also factored in how many people suffered from health concerns related to lack of sleep. Issues such as obesity, physical inactivity, smoking, and excessive drinking. After we slept on everything, we ranked the places where you can't and can rest easy. Who are the sleepiest cities, 1 to 10? Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Toledo, Ohio, New Orleans, Louisiana, Detroit, Michigan, Cincinnati, Ohio, Lexington, Kentucky, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Las Vegas, Nevada, Jacksonville, Florida, and finally number 10, Providence, Rhode Island. the most refreshed cities from 91 to 100, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Lincoln, Nebraska, Salt Lake City, Utah, Madison, Wisconsin, San Francisco, California, Burlington, Vermont, Denver, Colorado, Colorado Springs, Aurora, Colorado, and number 100 most refreshed, Boise, Idaho. So sleepiest is Philadelphia. Philly scored poorly in all assessments. Its residents don't get enough sleep, go to bed just before midnight on average, and have high inactivity ratings. One explanation? Enough darkness can make your circadian rhythms go screwy. And Philadelphia suffers from some of the worst light pollution in the U.S. Number 8 on the list, Las Vegas. The 24-hour party requires around-the-clock employees, and research shows that night shift workers are at greater risk developing asthma, depression, and heart disease, the last of which may be partly due to irregular diet habits that may or may not involve it, the all-you-can-eat buffets and such. It's hard to change your shift, but it's easy to pack a breakfast. And finally, 99, Aurora, Colorado. You go, Colorado. Colorado placed 3 cities on our best rested rankings, maybe because only 27% of Coloradans report sleeping less than 7 hours a night on average. Residents go above and beyond the guidelines for physical activity. Moderate intensity aerobic exercise for at least 150 minutes per week, and muscle strengthening activities on 2 days a week. Well, we come to the end of our program. I've been reading Men's Health Magazine. I'm Peter Gilmore. This has been a production of Sight New Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Health Department will have immunization clinics 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we continue our series of Oscar-winning films. Every week, we're selecting one audio-described movie from each decade leading up to this year's Academy Awards broadcast on April 25th. We're now to the 1980s. Because of the recent death of Texas author Larry McMurtry, Saturday, we're presenting the movie based on his book, Terms of Endearment, from 1983. This film fits perfectly within our series as it was nominated for 11 awards and won 5, including one for Best Picture.
Deborah Winger is Emma Greenway Horton.
I got some good news.
What's that?
I'm unofficially pregnant. You're not happy for me. You're going to get so mad if you're not happy.
Shirley MacLaine is Aurora Greenway, her mother.
Why should I be happy about being a grandmother?
Jack Nicholson is former astronaut Garrett Breedlove.
Wind in the hair, leg in the pencil!
I am not enjoying this.
And they are all coming to terms.
What is it, Mom?
You are not special enough to overcome a bad marriage.
Your mother boycotted your wedding. She hates your husband, and she only holds you in medium esteem.
Oh, and that's the first time I stopped hugging first.
I like that.
How is your life going to get better if you keep having children with that man? What miracle is going to come along to rescue you?
Wait over by the car, honey.
No, come on.
Wait over by the car, honey.
But I want...
Wait over by the car, honey. Now! Now! Now!
Nice boys. You're great with them, too.
I don't really think he wants to have anything more to do with me.
Is it because you wouldn't go to bed with him?
On a first date, Emma?
It's hardly a first date, Mother. I mean, you've been living 10 feet away from him for 15 years. Why don't you talk about the real reason?
I don't know what you mean.
Because it's been about that long since you've done it.
I was doing laps when you called. Lucky for us.
Sarah's gonna kill me.
Relax, baby. No, it's gonna be great.
Who do you think?